Before we get into the story of Christina Gill, we've got something we'd like to share. The Saturday following the release of this episode, May the 14th, 2022, from 1 to 4 p.m., a memorial will be held for Leon Lorales in Brownwood, Texas, at Lake Brownwood State Park. Many of you might have listened to our episodes covering the case, but in case you have not, Leon was slain in what can only be described as a senseless, cold-blooded act on May 10, 1996, and Brown County authorities have since been unable to identify his killer. If there's any way you can make it to this day of remembrance, it would mean the world to us and to Leon's family. His case is in desperate need of awareness and attention. Leon Lorales will not be forgotten. We'll provide the address to the event in the show notes. You can also help by donating to the family's GoFundMe campaign to hire a private investigator and create a memorial. We'll provide a link to that in the show notes as well. I hope to see y'all at Leon's Day of Remembrance. Also, in this episode, we will be heavily referencing the disappearance of 19-year-old Ashley Fuller Reed, since her missing persons case has been theorized to be connected with the Christina Gill case. Many specific and important details of Ashley's disappearance, however, will not be discussed here. So if you haven't already, we strongly recommend you go back 2 episodes and listen to Ashley Fuller Reed, Disappearance in Dallas. Okay, now on to the episode.
The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Elm Street in Dallas, Texas begins just west of the spot President John F. Kennedy was assassinated and stretches east a couple miles through the neighborhood Deep Ellum, where it ends. Long before Deep Ellum was a weekend playground for yuppie hipsters and 90s grunge tribute bands, it was a place of hope and of first freedom for many. After the Civil War, former slaves settled the area now known as Deep Ellum, transforming it into one of the first, if not the first, residential and commercial neighborhoods in Dallas that welcomed and was run by freed men and European immigrants. It quickly became known as Deep Ellum due to the way the residents pronounced Deep Elm, which referred to, of course, Elm Street. The area grew and prospered into the turn of the 20th century, becoming the place where Robert Munger, inventor of the cotton gin, built his first factory, the Continental Gin Company. In 1914, Henry Ford chose Deep Ellum for one of his earliest plants to assemble his famous cars, and Ford's Model T became ingrained in the area's rich history. William Sidney Pittman, Texas's first black architect, designed the Union Bankers Trust building on Elm Street, which was constructed in 1916 and housed many of Dallas's first black attorneys and doctors, among other professions. Word about Deep Ellum's purposeful desegregation and openness to anyone regardless of skin color, nationality, or religious beliefs spread. It was, after all, an anomaly in Dallas at the time, an exception to the unwritten rules of the entire state of Texas, in fact. By the late 1910s, the area was rich with diversity and the business owners' skill sets were extensive, accomplished, and energetic. The Deep Ellum experiment was, perhaps, one of the most successful, sociologically speaking, and the culture, particularly the music, ultimately defined this district. Even before he became a Texas true crime story in himself, and before he was recorded by the Lomax brothers, who were collecting American folk music for the Library of Congress in the early 1930s, Huddy William Leadbetter, or Leadbelly, frequented Deep Ellum clubs, playing his inimitable blues guitar picking and wailing. The influx of blues and jazz nightclubs, domino parlors with backroom craps games, and Deep Ellum's red light district made crime there an inevitability, and the suburban boom of the 1950s further pulled businesses like grocery stores and law offices out of the area. By the 1970s, Deep Ellum's once modern and industry housing architecture was largely vacant, the area run down and nearly void of life. It was ripe for a punk scene to come in, and it did. In the early 80s, Deep Ellum was virtually the only place for societal outsiders to cut loose for hundreds of miles. The only thing that compared within that distance, perhaps, was Zero's New Wave Lounge in Fort Worth. Along with Dallas's plans to redevelop Deep Ellum as an arts district, Dallas's punk rock scene began revitalizing the area as music venues, art galleries, counterculture, and subculture shops moved in. By 1990, the scene on Elm, Main, Commerce, and Canton streets was nearly as alive as it had ever been, as bands from a wide range of genres drew in crowds, from punk and post-punk to hip-hop and reggae, and from industrial and techno to glam rock. Deep Ellum attracted punks, goths, rockabilly revivalists, bikers, and metalheads, or heshers as we like to call them back then. Along with scene rivalries and large groups of skinheads frequenting Deep Ellum solely to provoke violence, often heavy drinking and drug use contributed to the area's fast rise in crime. Something that was almost non-existent there, or at least not reported, during the early and mid-1980s when the punk rock scene was doing all they could to stay low-key and cop-free. Still, the downtown arts district in the late 80s and early 90s was a home away from home for outcasts, outsiders, and artists. An after-dark and weekend home to those who hid their wild sides, or true selves, in cubicles during the weekdays. Deep Ellum certainly attracted 20-year-old Christina Marie Gill, and perhaps, in some way, contributed to the opportunity for her killer to strike. A lifelong Dallasite, Christina Marie Gill, known to most as Chris, was born in the county on January 15, 1970, to parents Bess and John. Chris was incredibly intelligent, but the ease at which she became bored after quickly mastering a challenge was perhaps overlooked at first, since she was described as a late bloomer. Chris has also been described as hypersensitive. But again, she was intelligent and friendly. She had no shortage of friends. What was described as her chameleon-like quality allowed her to befriend folks throughout every conceivable clique, from the goth, punk, and metal scenes to the preps, or the bowheads as they used to be known. Chris enjoyed the company of all sorts of people and discovered early on that a change of clothing and makeup was the easiest way to move freely through varying teenage groups and scenes. She and her parents lived in a working middle-class neighborhood in northeast Dallas, their home off Promenade Lane. By the time she graduated high school and began liberal arts courses at a Dallas junior college, Chris still relied on her parents for support and for protection against the dangers of the world. There were certainly plenty of dangers to be found in and around Dallas by the time Chris turned 20 years old on January 15, 1990. The year would turn out to be the city's second most violent and deadly, and in fact, the very day Chris left her teenaged years behind, Ashley Fuller Reed's Uncle Bob discovered her abandoned 1984 Chevy Citation in nearby Mesquite. No other sign of Ashley would ever be found again, and after a change of plans with a friend a few months later, Christina Gill, too, went missing. On Thursday, May 3, 1990, Chris Gill and a friend had plans to head to Deep Ellum to go clubbing. At the last minute, however, her friend backed out. Not wanting to let the night go to waste, Chris decided she would head to Deep Ellum anyway, so she dressed in a white shirt, a long black skirt complemented by a wide black belt, and black tights. She headed out in her black 1989 Ford Mustang. Chris's first stop was a club on Commerce Street called On the Rocks, where a friend of hers' band was playing, the music described as hard rock. This club generally catered to the metal crowd, or more specifically the hair metal crowd, featuring out-of-town acts like Dangerous Toys and Saxon, and local bands like Bellicose. At On the Rocks, Chris met up with several friends. They watched the bands for a little while before driving to another club called The Basement in Dallas's Lower Greenville neighborhood on the corner of Greenville Avenue and Park Lane. Presumably, Chris and her friends didn't stay at The Basement for long before driving back to Deep Ellum's On the Rocks, where she was last seen leaving sometime around when the club closed its doors for the night at 2 a.m. The timeline and witness accounts are unfortunately kind of a blur, as Chris and her friends had been drinking heavily. Though none of her friends would admit to such in their signed witness statement, Dallas homicide detective Jim Gallagher later said he believed it was highly possible the group had been using narcotics that night as well. This particular circle of friends, Gallagher said, were known to regularly use, quote, everything from marijuana to LSD, end quote. The latter was going around something fierce during this time in the DFW area. Detective Gallagher wasn't simply making claims that were not supported. An On the Rocks doorman is quoted as saying he'd never seen Chris Gill in the state she was that evening, meaning she was highly intoxicated.
She was never, ever like that,
the doorman later told a reporter. Since we're talking about reporters here, one article states that Chris's friends didn't try and stop her from driving in her highly inebriated state, and the way it's written seems to be an attempt to shame them for this. It is important to remember, however, that Chris's friends were also very intoxicated, and it remains unclear just how the reporter purportedly knew this to be true, or if it is true at all. Whatever the case, Chris Gill vanished into thin air after leaving On the Rocks sometime around 2 a.m. on Friday, May 4th, 1990. Though she was a homebody through and through, Chris sometimes went out partying and stayed at friends' homes until the following day. On the occasions she did, Chris would call her mother Bess in the morning and explain that she didn't want to drive home, but also didn't want to call and wake her up. She'd always let her mom know that she'd be home before noon, and she usually was. So, on May 4th, 1990, both Bess and Chris's father John weren't too worried about their daughter's failure to return home the previous night. That changed by the afternoon, when they'd still heard nothing from Chris. Bess began calling her daughter's friends, all of them, the mother later said. None knew where Chris ended up after leaving Deep Ellum. Bess and John's slight worry slowly turned to full-out panic until it was too much to bear. John called the Dallas police that evening and reported Chris missing. It isn't haphazard to assume that one of the Dallas Police Department Youth Division's primary tasks concerned locating runaway children, i.e. people under the age of 18. After a wish to locate was issued to all patrol officers after Chris Gill was reported missing, the youth division is where her case ended up. This is at least somewhat odd considering Chris was 20 years old. Perhaps at the time the unit handled folks under 21 years of age. I've been unable to get a clear answer on that. Anyway, helping this decision make sense is that at the time, the youth division at Dallas PD was also investigating the disappearance of Ashley Fuller, who at 19 years old was also technically an adult. Homicide detective Jim Gallagher later explained, too, that when the investigation into Chris Gill's missing persons case began, the department had no reason to believe foul play was involved. But you'll see soon that there's a problem with that statement as well. The Town Plaza apartments are located at 8620 Park Lane in Lower Greenville, just 0.6 miles east of The Basement, the club where Chris and her friends visited in between visits to On the Rocks in Deep Ellum. Perhaps it's important to note that the distance between this apartment complex and the club On the Rocks is around 8 miles, almost a straight shot up Highway 75, which is an approximate 20-minute drive in current-day Dallas. Likely, it took a little less time at 2 a.m. in the morning in May of 1990. The day after she was reported missing, when the cops found Chris's black 1989 Ford Mustang parked in a parking lot at the Town Plaza Apartments, nothing in or around the vehicle looked amiss. Officers observed her shoes in the car, but other than that, nothing was off. However, things were not as they seemed by the time the police discovery was made. The previous morning, just hours after Chris Gill left Deep Ellum, an apartment maintenance man and cleaning woman found a purse, makeup bag, and car keys laying on the pavement next to Chris Gill's black Mustang. The items were picked up and taken to the apartment manager's office, changing hands at least twice. When the cops finally got a hold of the items, it was discovered that they belonged to Chris. The part of town where Chris's car was found troubled police. Dallas homicide detective Jim Gallagher later commented that when he was a sexual assault investigator, he worked many cases in that area. It was popular, he said, with city sex offenders, rapists, due to the high concentration of single women in and around Lower Greenville. But the cops soon turned their attention to another discovery. Not far from where Chris Gill's car was parked lived a friend who had been with her at the clubs the last time she was seen, a guy named Steve. Steve told police he got home at sunup Friday morning after partying all night. He did notice Chris's Ford Mustang parked there when he arrived, he told detectives, but he didn't think much of it. Since he was likely highly intoxicated, that is certainly believable, and anyway, Steve was investigated and had alibi witnesses. Police did learn a potentially important detail from him, however, one that might explain why Chris ended up at the Town Center apartment complex. She and her friends had originally intended to meet up at Steve's for a party after leaving On the Rocks in Deep Ellum. Either her friends decided not to do so while she was there and neglected to tell her, or they decided against the after-party at Steve's after she had already left. Because of the reporting on the story, it is unclear which of these scenarios it is, but either way, the meetup at Steve's was called off.
They never saw her,
Dallas homicide detective Judy Kratz said of Chris Gill's friends. Finally, in the Sunday edition of the Dallas Morning News on May 6, 1990, a story about Chris's disappearance was featured, though it was buried deep on page 35A. A description accompanied the article, including what she was wearing when she was last seen, a white shirt, black skirt and belt, and black tights. The description states that she wore silver jewelry, stood 5 feet 6 inches tall, and weighed 95 pounds. Her long hair was black and her eyes brown. After the discovery of her vehicle, the discovery that her personal belongings had been found on the pavement outside her car, and while police investigated the admittedly zero leads they had, Chris Gill's family sprung into action to find their missing loved one. The Gill family sacrificed almost everything to find Chris. Her brother drove to Dallas from North Houston immediately upon hearing about his sister's disappearance. John, Chris's father, quit his job to search for his missing daughter around the clock. John printed countless missing persons posters in color and hung them all over Dallas. Chris's mother Bess's family, her parents, sisters, and brother worked diligently hanging posters and searching. Some family members took leaves of absence from their places of employment to help full-time. Virtually all of the Gill family's friends also wasted no time offering help and support in the searches, including old friends who John said came out of the woodwork. The Gill family leased a helicopter to aid in the efforts. A team of private investigators was hired by the Gill family too, who quickly claimed to have developed several leads and identified persons of interest. These claims appear to have been nothing more than blown smoke, however. We'll get to that soon. The Dallas police were investigating, of course, but it was the Gill family who did all the heavy lifting.
"We've put the money and the manpower into this,"
John Gill said.
"We supplied the manpower to get the advantage."
Detectives with Dallas's youth division were not under the delusion that Chris Gill just ran off. They knew she was a homebody, and it was easy to read between the lines of detectives' comments to reporters. But they simply had no idea what happened to Chris, or where she might be. Meanwhile, John Gill had enlisted the help of taxi companies in the city, who agreed to display information about Chris in their cabs. Businesses throughout Dallas obliged John's requests to place posters in ideal sight of customers and passersby. After a month, neither John nor Bess had given up hope that their daughter was still alive. They told reporters they would never give up. The Gills' efforts certainly were not in vain. The posters and publicity they themselves were responsible for led to plenty of tips. As discussed briefly in our episode on Ashley Fuller Reed's disappearance, however, those leads were not unlike virtually every other missing person's case, either mistaken identity or just plain bullshit. Among the hundreds of sightings called in to the Dallas police were reports of Chris Gill as far away as California. In July 1990, John Gill got a call from a man who claimed to have seen Chris in a Wendy's fast food restaurant in the Dallas suburb Oak Cliff, sometime in either late May or early June. Chris was making strange facial expressions at him as she ate with a man, this tipster told John Gill. She was in distress and trying to alert him, though he did not realize that was her intent, this caller said, until he boarded a Dallas City bus and saw her missing persons poster inside. The fact that this man waited 8 weeks to call John Gill, however, is certainly discrediting. Anyway, no tips called into police or the Gill family resulted in any substantive leads. The same month John Gill received the Oak Cliff sighting call, he was re-energized when the police decided they needed to employ a new strategy in their search for both his daughter and Ashley Fuller Reed, who disappeared from the Dallas suburb of Mesquite in January of 1990. When the missing persons cases of Chris Gill and Ashley Reed were transferred out of the Dallas Police Department's Youth Division and into Homicide, a major shift in the direction of the investigation was made. Homicide Detective John Westphalen assured reporters that he and other homicide detectives' investigation tactics would be much different.
"We'll look at these cases as potential homicides, not just missing people,"
Detective Westphalen said, adding,
"We have certain ways and methods that are more detailed to start an investigation, and we have more time to work on these cases than other detectives."
John Gill was thrilled that his daughter's case would be handed over to Dallas's best, and his optimism was rewarded quickly, since homicide detectives announced they had several new leads within a week of taking on the missing persons cases. But John wasn't just pleased that his daughter's case was turned over to homicide. He also expressed his feelings on the division taking over Ashley Reed's disappearance. He always kept Ashley's case in mind, and often brainstormed about ways to help her family. Ashley Fuller Reed's family, like the Gill family, was pleased with this new direction. By September of 1990, however, the cops' leads had fizzled, and John Gill was dealing with an entirely different problem, private investigator William C. Deere. We've spoken about William Deere several times on Gone Cold. From the poisoning murder of wax museum heiress Patsy Wright in Arlington in 1987, to the execution of Juan Leon Lorales in Brown County in 1996. The family of Christina Marie Gill had as big a problem with the private Dick as the families of Patsy before and Leon several years later, and perhaps similar results, or rather lack thereof. John Gill had hired William Deere not long after Chris went missing, and the girl's father said he only got shoddy, sketchy, and questionable paperwork in return for the $32,000 he had paid the man.
"He is dishonest. He's just a con artist,"
John said of Deere.
"He's no detective at all."
In September of 1990, John Gill filed a criminal complaint against William C. Deere and Associates with the Dallas County District Attorney's Office. John and Bess would later bring a lawsuit against William Deere, and an insurance company, too, ended up suing the man for not paying agreed-upon settlements to the Gills and other plaintiffs, but apparently keeping the liability insurance money that was paid to him to do so. I could do an entire series on this guy and a few other private dicks, but the point is, the Gills paid him more than 30 grand for basically nothing. As far as we know, nothing came of the criminal charges John Gill filed against Deere, and he remained unaccountable to continue doing what it is he does. A few months after the stress of dealing with the debacle that is William C. Deere, the Gills' worst imaginable scenario turned to actuality. On Wednesday, December 5th, 1990, just before 5 p.m., a man hunting squirrels at the Trinity River Bottoms near Cedar Crest Boulevard in South Dallas had trouble believing his eyes as he gazed up a tree there. It looked like a human body draped over two of the tree's branches at the tree top, about 8 to 10 feet up. When police arrived at the scene a short time later, they pulled the badly decomposed body from the tree. It was a woman, police told the press at the time, but the state of decomp made it impossible to identify age or race. It also made it difficult to determine the manner of death, since there were no outwardly obvious injuries. The body was sent to the Dallas County Medical Examiner right away for an autopsy. On Thursday, December 6, 1990, pathologists worked to determine the cause of death after the body was identified. Earlier in the day, detectives were prompted to call the Gills when they realized that several pieces of jewelry found on this body matched descriptions they'd given police of Chris's jewelry. John recognized a few pieces right away, and soon after, three different physicians matched the body's teeth to Christina Marie Gill's dental records. John and Bess Gill were crushed, of course, but they refused to stop fighting for answers, and at first even refused to believe beyond a shadow of a doubt that the body was even their daughter's. While pathologists worked to identify a cause of death, Dallas homicide detectives began theorizing.
"We kicked around the theory that the girl was kidnapped, brought to the area, sexually assaulted. She flees her attacker, she climbs a tree, naked, and dies. Nobody finds her,"
Dallas homicide detective Jim Gallagher said. But because of heavy rains and flooding along the Trinity River the day after Chris disappeared, the cops ultimately decided her body ended up in the submerged tree after being washed downstream and becoming tangled in its branches. Her body appeared to have spent a great deal of time hidden beneath the leaves and branches of the tree, police said. But the fact that any tissue at all remained suggested, too, that decomposition was slowed, or that weather conditions allowed for some sort of mummification. Police knew that the condition of the body, the state of decomposition, could have obscured knife or gunshot wounds. But Chris Gill's cause of death turned out to be neither of those things. On Tuesday, December 18, 1990, after bringing in a forensic anthropologist to inspect her remains, The Dallas County Medical Examiner ruled that Chris's death was a homicide. After the pathologist identified a fracture in her skull, the forensic anthropologist examined it and determined she had died from blunt force trauma. It was impossible, the medical examiner said, to determine if Chris Gill had been sexually assaulted. Dirt samples found on Chris's skin were sent out for testing in an attempt to identify where her killer originally dumped her body, but the results of those tests have never been made public. Although he'd quit his job and spent more than $100,000 searching for Chris, John Gill said the only thing he ever regretted was hiring William C. Deere. He said it was his daughter and everything he did had to be done. He was not through by any means. There were still answers to get. Since the Gill family resources had been completely drained, friends of the family set up a fund to pay for funeral services and burial. The murder of Chris Gill is not well known, not even around the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. But the small circle who does discuss it, including police, all have theories of their own. Many believe her case is connected to Ashley Fuller Reed's disappearance, something Detective Jim Gallagher doubts but thinks is possible. Never say never is how he put it. The detective is sure that Chris was killed within hours of parking her car and being abducted at the Town Plaza Apartments, but if that is not the case, she had to have been killed no more than 2 days after, since that is when the flooding occurred. Trinity River water levels remained high for months after, but the top of the tree where Chris was ultimately found was exposed, though it was possible that she remained at least partially submerged, which might have slowed decomposition. Still, the fact that any tissue remained on her body after 7 months and a North Texas summer is astounding. The fact that she was never found, however, is easily explainable. For months after her disappearance, the tree Chris Gill's body was in was only accessible by boat. By the time the water levels lowered and her body was hidden until the leaves fell, which occurred near the first week of December, Detective Gallagher seemed to firmly believe Chris was assaulted, kidnapped, raped, slain, and dumped within hours of leaving on the Rocks Club in Deep Ellum. Like the whereabouts of Ashley Fuller Reed, however, what happened to Christina Marie Gill and who is responsible remains unknown. The financial and emotional toll on the Gill family was immeasurable. Having to fight for damages against William C. Deere only exacerbated their anguish. John and Bess Gill never gave up their efforts to find out what happened to their daughter. John died never knowing in 1999, and Bess in 2004. If you have any information about the murder of Christina Marie Gill, please call Texas Crime Stoppers at 800-252-TIPS or 800-252-8477. The Dallas Morning News, The Dallas Observer, Court Documents, and the book Murderers Among Us, Unsolved Homicides, Mysterious Deaths, and Killers at Large, by Hugh Ainsworth and Stephen G. Michaud, were used as sources for this episode. You can support the show at patreon.com/gonecoldpodcast. There, you can get the show ad-free and enjoy Patreon-exclusive episodes that tell stories of mostly solved Texas crimes and the bad actors who perpetrated them. I get those out as much as I can, which is not as often as I would like. Another way you can support Gone Cold is by leaving us a 5-star rating and written review on iTunes or wherever else you listen. Thank you in advance. Those reviews help Gone Cold's visibility, which helps new listeners find us, which increases the potential for someone with information hearing the show and reporting what they know to authorities. Thanks for listening, y'all.